The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 274, a panel, A Taste of Everything, Why We Read Ken Wilber, with Dan Weatherspoon, Mary Beth Raines, and John T. Kessler.
Welcome, everyone, to session 274, a panel presentation called A Taste of Everything, Why We Read Ken Wilber. Who's this unusual-looking person here up on the overhead projector? My name's Dan Weatherspoon. I'm the moderator of this panel as well as a panelist. Normally, as when I introduce things, I get to introduce the others. I better at least tell you a little bit about myself, which is different than the typical Sunstone experience. Member of the church, but even as a child, I remember always having a curiosity about the big picture. And so, when I finally discovered Ken Wilber, it was a real kindred spirit there that somebody's at least going to attempt to try to make everything fit together. I did a bachelor's degree at BYU in philosophy, and then a master's and a PhD in religion and religious studies. And I didn't really discover Ken Wilber, though, until about 4 years after I've completed my doctorate. And it was in the context of developmental theory. And he was mentioned. I started with James Fowler in Stages of Faith, and then through Fowler and just really finding the helpfulness in understanding developmental theory, Wilber was a name who, you know, appeared on the scene. And over the last 6 years, well, first of all, like anybody you discover, you know, you do nothing but read him and you spend all your money on these books. I put a few of the books, Lori, the one on deep ecology was for another presentation. I mean, those are all the books that were up in my office. But there's a lot of Ken Wilber books over there, and there's another 15 in existence or something out there. So he's written a lot of books, and so it can be an expensive proposition to like Ken Wilber, but I did find him fascinating, and that's going to be my role today. I'm going to try to teach Ken Wilber and the basics of his integral vision in about a half hour, and it will be mostly me kind of giving you a taste, but hopefully a feeling of enthusiasm and a sense that there's a lot there that you might want to check out for yourself. First of all, the order we'll go in is John Kessler will come up and introduce you a little bit to Ken Wilber, the person. Then I'll teach his stuff. Then we'll go to Mary Beth Raines. Mary Beth Raines is a licensed clinical social worker and a marriage and family therapist who is in private practice here in Salt Lake City. She's written and spoken about mental health, social issues, and Mormonism for over 25 years. She's currently on the board of directors of Shamad, which is a group in Salt Lake City working to bridge the Mormon-non-Mormon divides in Utah. She's always curious about new ways to see things and apply them to the practicalities of life. And that's where I believe the Ken Wilber part comes into this bio. Her 3 children and 9 grandchildren, although spread throughout the United States, are her current biggest source of new opportunities to see the world newly. So, and Mary Beth, as it says in the program, tends to sneak Wilber in many, many of her counseling situations, even without mentioning him. John Kessler is an attorney, a consultant, and a lecturer. As an attorney, he practices commercial law and mediation. As a consultant, lecturer, and teacher, he works in the area of individual, organizational, and community integration and transformation. Now remember this word integration, because that's going to be huge today. He recently has been the chair of several nonprofit groups, including the University of Utah Hospitals and Clinics, the Berkana Institute, and the Integrative Health Network. John publishes occasionally, and one of his essays, which was a contribution to the book by Phil Barlow, edited many years ago, called A Thoughtful Faith. Just today, John, just to tell you, or was it yesterday, somebody came up to me and said that your essay and Leonard Arrington's are two that he has reread hundreds of times. And so that was a real compliment to you. He just thinks you're terrific, and he's told me that I need to have you do Pillars of My Faith next year, so watch out for me. Avoid me. No, but anyway. Most recently, and most applicable to John's presentation today is that he is a founding member, or at least on the board, of the Kansian Zen Center here in Salt Lake City, in which he facilitates something that Ken Wilber himself is very enthusiastic about. Just had Genpo Roshi, who founded this process called the Big Mind Process. John and Genpo were there, and it's a way that really works for Western thinkers to kind of to get a taste of a satori, a taste of that non-dual experience, of that sense of yourself as witness rather than full identification with your body and your emotions and all that stuff. John teaches that, and then he's also a founding member of the Integral Institute, which is Wilber's organization for bringing integral awareness and practices alive and uniting all human disciplines. So we have a real star and Ken Wilber associate here with us. So let's turn the time over to John for a few minutes to introduce you to Ken Wilber, and then I'll do my best to make it sing.
I'll just give you a brief, broad brush impression of Ken, because that's really all you can give. He's just kind of this force of nature that seems to be full of contradictions and is truly a rare genius. And as all geniuses, you can't really categorize them. He did his doctoral work in biophysics, but rather than finishing his dissertation, he decided to wash dishes for about 8 years in Boulder, Colorado, where he read omnivorously. He's really a polymath and can read about 10 books in about 10 hours. He devours everything. And fortunately, he has the gift to come up with ways not to necessarily think about totally brand new ideas, but to how to synthesize everything, how everything fits. His motto has always been, nobody's smart enough to be wrong all of the time. In other words, everybody's right unless you're totally off your rocker. It's just that everybody also is partial. And so in that great larger whole, how do you put those partial perspectives together? He published his first book when he was about 23 called No Boundaries, which was a breakthrough book in understanding the Buddhist outlook in more or less non-mystical terms and sort of descriptive developmental terms. And he's become one of probably the premier person in the world who's brought the Eastern wisdom and primarily Western developmental psychology, the full spectrum of being and all contexts and dimensions of the human being and of human knowledge together. And he's openly evolving. He always talks about, well, this was Wilber 1, this was Wilber 2. He's up to about Wilber 5 or 6 right now because he's open. It's an open system and keeps reworking his system. He's a little bit daunting to read. He's a very dense writer, but well worth getting into if you can handle that kind of dense writing, because he has brilliant insights, is a very strong theory to help things fit together. And that's what Dan is going to just give us a brief overview of the basics of his theoretical framework.
That was terrific, but I don't think he's that hard to read. So don't be scared. To me, he's a gorgeous writer. I mean, there are some phrases in there. In fact, we in our early going, we were all going to collect our favorite quotes from him and hand it as a handout, and it just didn't happen in the melee up here. But he's dense, and I think you probably meant it more in the terms of it's just loaded, you know. But I think his prose is really quite wonderful, and there's some moments of just gorgeous stuff. So maybe. there you go. And honestly, that's why I'll tell you, I'd recommend this book right here, this Brief History of Everything. The newer editions have a different cover, but what the Brief History of Everything is this book. It's called Sex, Ecology, and Spirit. And it's in a question and answer format of, you know, in sex ecology and spirit, you say this. What is it exactly you meant? You know, and it's really a very...
The Reader's Digest version
of this beast right here. So
Somebody said to Ken, Ken, people can't read you. You've got to say it.
Oh, okay. And also, as I try to shotgun this out here for you, I have invited these two people to interrupt and to add their little bits, because what we're really going to try to accomplish here is teach you the following: all quadrants, all levels, lines, stages, no, types, and what I know it here. Quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. So we're going to try to do a lot here. I'm mostly going to concentrate on the first three. First of all, Ken Wilber is kind of called by most people an integral map maker. You know, in that he is trying to map all fields of knowledge, all consciousness types, all social systems or something into this great thing. He has come up and said that he'd rather be referred to as a storyteller, and at that, a cosmic storyteller. And when he uses the word cosmic, he spells it with a K, which is apparently the original Pythagorean contribution to the language. And cosmos at that point meant patterned nature of all domains of existence, from matter to math to theos, and not merely the physical universes, which we usually are meant by the cosmos with a C. So for him, cosmos is everything, and that's in its original sense. So cosmos with a K. And so he wants to be known as a cosmic storyteller. And what really does emerge from here, as you'll see it, and I'm not going to put a big chart up there first and get you all scared, but you'll see that his map, it does. It has a beginning, and it shows progression. So it is actually a story, and a story in very interesting ways. Now, John mentioned the fundamental insight that we really have to get here, and that is that everybody is right. Whenever he starts, he says, if there's any thought or something that had enough power to really sort of stick in any way, shape, or form, clearly there's truth to it. It has power that we need to honor, Seth, but it doesn't mean that it has the full load. My favorite scripture in the DNC, section 93, verses 30, says, all truth is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it. Now, I don't know that Ken's really going to go into God placing it here, but this emphasis that truth is independent in its sphere and that truths are in different spheres is important. Now, also the independent part, Ken might fight with, but it's this idea that any truth has power to act for itself. And so Ken is honoring that kind of power. So as I mentioned, we're going to talk about five basic things, and these are the categories that Ken says are, or at least, again, he doesn't claim his is the only map, but these are the five sort of things that he thinks captures the whole of knowledge the best: quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. And it's often referred to in shorthand, in case any of us do it, we'll say AQUAL, A-Q-A-L, all quadrants, all levels, is sort of just this little shorthand for that. Do I dare throw up the quadrant map? Okay, don't be afraid of this. By all quadrants, what Ken is talking about, quadrant means four, so obviously there's four. I should have brought the laser pointer. The quadrants are left and right, which are individual and collective, or you see here, individual up there, individual, and then, oh, sorry, top and bottom are individual and collective. Left and right are, the right-hand side is external, and the left-hand side is internal. And so basically what we're talking about here is things in this quadrant that he wants to describe are things that you, that are individual things that you can describe as an outsider. You're looking at the outside of them. So for instance, this is the domain of science and physics and chemistry. You'll see here, how do you teach without going levels already? You'll see things like atoms are smaller than molecules, which are smaller than prokaryotes, cells, all the way up there. And you'll see that basically what we have here is a progression of smaller to larger, less developed to more developed in this singular exterior sort of things, the things that you can describe there. Same thing with the left. God, this is so scary here. I wanted, you know what I really ought to do? I'm going to stop here. Don't look at anything but the quadrants. What he does reduce these two, though, he talks about things in terms of the I domain. Can you see that? The individual. The I domain. The we domain, because this is the interior collective. So you would use the pronoun I up here, we over here. And then what would this be? It'd be an it. So in other words, when you're talking about this, you're talking about it. And when you're down here in the plural, you're talking about its. So I, we, it are the domains. And then what these also, just to say, he talks about the big three. And if you think of the history of philosophy, like Kant has these three great critiques. He critiques reason, pure reason, practical reason, and judgment. And often in Aristotle and Plato, I think it's called the good, the true, and the beautiful. And so the big three also correspond here. The good is in the we domain, because what we as internal decisions with each other, we determine what is good. The I is the beautiful, interior aesthetics. The field of aesthetics is up there. And then the true is this. So don't we sort of tend in science to say that's true, that's scientific truth that we can prove. So some of his terms, which I'm doing a bad job with, that you would need to do is add I, we, it, and its when you're talking about the different things in the universe. What should I say besides that?
I'm visual, and so one visual device that works for me about the quadrants to see how they develop over the stages and that you get more depth and breadth with each stage is think of an inverted pyramid for the moment that has, much like the older pyramids, little step ladder sort of things, so that at the bottom or the center, then you have less depth and breadth at each stage, and with each succeeding one, you get exponentially more depth and breadth, and so that helps me see it.
Another point that he makes is every discipline or every point of view tends to be lodged in one of these four quadrants. And when anybody comes from that point of view, they think their quadrant view is the whole, and they spend all of their time trying to disprove the points of view in the other three quadrants. His point is they're all correct, and they all have their own particular approaches to truth and understanding.
I definitely was going to plan on getting to both those things, but no, I'm glad to get them here because one of the tendencies, and this is kind of just in my little extras at the end of this whole thing, was especially which side gets most of the play as far as respect out in the world today? Isn't it? It's this right side stuff. It's the scientific stuff. It's the things to do there. So Ken has a fun thing that he calls flatland. And basically what he says is there's a tendency today to want to reduce everything in the individual and the collective interior and reduce it to stuff that science likes. So for instance, you have a mystical experience. I'm having a satori or something. What's science been doing lately? Well, they're saying, well, that's just endorphins in the brain, or if we stimulate this part of the brain, you're going to produce that. And so it's this idea of totally discounting what our interiors are and preferring these. And so what he's saying is, with his term flatland, it's like you're taking this whole side and collapsing it here to the right-hand side, and the world is becoming flat. It has no depth. It has no beauty. It has no music anymore when you do it. But Ken, on the other hand, would never deny that there is a brain state attached with your satori. In other words, they both have good things to say, that anything happens in one quadrant has a correspondence in every one, and we'll try to make that work out here in a minute. Okay, quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. It's interesting that we would normally go with levels, and that's what I started to do. But Ken, I think lately has been emphasizing lines next, hasn't he? Yeah, so let me just quickly introduce you to lines. So kind of forget this for a second. What he means by lines are that we all recognize that there are different kinds of intelligences. And I don't mean that in the Mormon sense. There's, you know, what we think of typically as cognitive abilities, but then you've heard terms like emotional intelligence, and then there's morality. There's things like spiritual intelligences. Kinesthetic is his label for the idea of when your body really functions well, like a well-trained athlete would be highly developed in the kinesthetic line. There'd be musical lines. There's mathematical abilities that some people have and other people don't. And so what one of the important things besides interiors and exteriors, social and stuff, is when we are trying to capture the truth of everything, we need to recognize that not everybody is going to have equal development in the different lines. So, for instance, somebody can be highly cognitive developed and very low moral development. And, like, who would you think of who might fit that? Rush Limbaugh, ouch. Like, one of the ones that Kendall uses, like, Nazi doctors. Clearly, you can be brilliant, and yet you're really kind of missing the boat on these lower levels. Or you could be a terrific athlete and yet not be very high on the cognitive development. You'd be high on the kinesthetic and not the other. Have musical ability, and if this came up the other day, somebody mentioned Mozart, perhaps a real cad and a real idiot, you know, as far as most of his, you know, interpersonal and those kinds of lines, be low there but high in these other things. And so when you're trying to capture the full picture of all reality, one of the things that's important for you to do is talk about different kinds of intelligences. And so, for instance, Lawrence Kohlberg is one of the theorists who's mapped the moral development line. James Fowler, Stages of Faith, probably can recognize as one of the best ones who's mapped the spiritual line and things like that. What is it? Anyway, there's other ones. So Ken recognizes anywhere between 12 and 24 developmental lines that we should consider whenever we're doing it. And there's some really neat stuff in here because he's warning you. You know, like, for instance, when people say, well, how do I find a good spiritual teacher? You know, Ken might say to you, you know, well, find one, of course, that, you know, challenges you and that you sense have and you have a connection with. But just because this spiritual teacher has these amazing abilities to enter into these altered states or whatever that you're craving doesn't mean that they're 100% developed in all the other lines. And so there's some nice ways to sort of differentiate between things that way. I'll go on. So the reason I mentioned lines here, because then we're talking about lines, but along each line there's certain developmental levels or stages or waves, and Ken calls them all sorts of things. I think let's do his levels. Okay, first of all, you can notice the easiest one to at least get on board with is here. We recognize that atoms, like she said, there's more of them in the universe, right? So they don't have a whole lot of depth to them, you know. But then the next thing up, atoms unite to molecules. So that means there's fewer molecules in the world than there are atoms. So that's the next step up. Then there's different types of cells. Finally, enough cells get together, you might get a neuronal organism. Eventually, you get to a cord, and then you get up to the reptilian brainstem. And have you all heard that we all have within us a reptilian brain? That's that sort of idea that at the reptile stage, enough of you is coordinated that you can sort of have sensory perception that sort of you respond to stimulus and things like that. A little bit more, but it's there. It's kind of your autonomic nervous system and stuff like that. Then on to the limbic system and the neocortex. We recognize that these are higher levels or stages of development along this it line of things in the universe. When you get to... what's easier, you guys, to go to systems of, like, archaic cultures, mythic cultures? What's easier? Okay, so Mary Beth will focus on individuals. So let's talk down here. Don't let this scare you again, because what we're going to show here in a minute is how all these line up. But level 9 here, when we think of cultures, Ken wants to help us see that different cultures each have their strengths and weaknesses, and some cultures are an evolutionary step above the others. So, for instance, where you really start seeing human beings come together is in what an archaic cultural type, which then moves on to magic, mythic, rational, and centauric. But his better language is archaic, magical, mythic, rational, and integral are the ones that he prefers, which are Gene Gebser's are one. But the idea is that as a culture kind of begins its early cultures, we might say, for instance, were magical. In other words, that they believed that if they did this, they could control the universe. You know, this act will make that happen. And so there was this direct connection between, if I do this, I create this. At some point, though, what happens? You realize, I didn't cause the rain by dancing around this rock myself or something like that. And so you might make an evolutionary step to the next one, which would be, okay, I can't do it myself, but God can do it. And so you move into a mythic, and you start to create a mythic structure that says, if I do this, I'll please the God, and the God will make the action happen. And so that might be a level of development that we saw, the Greek myths and so forth. If I, Zeus is unfriendly with me, I better take care of this so I can have that and all that stuff. But of course, then the Greeks also moved on to rational quite well. But, I'm embarrassed because I've never taught this. So mythic cultures are based upon a story in which there's a lot of petition for gods. I think I should have gone to agriculture, horticulture, all that as a better way to go. Let's do that. So I apologize. Here we go. Tribes, villages, foraging cultures, horticultural cultures, agrarian cultures, industrial cultures, informational cultures. The lower right has us moving through things that when you have a tribal culture, what's your way of sustenance? It's foraging. And tribal cultures can't sustain very many people because in a foraging, sort of economic thing, you can't accomplish a lot. Eventually, though, as things got bigger and they kind of went into village sort of structures, we have the emergence of horticulture. Now, horticulture, for the way he defines it, is planting and stuff that can be done with a hoe or a digging stick. Okay? Then let's hook up a plow to the back of this horse or this oxen or something like that. Then now we have another type of an agrarian one. And then eventually, as we develop nations and states, we go to the Industrial Revolution and the manufacturing and things like that. All these things are advances that can you sort of see what I'm trying to get at? That each one is an advance over the other. And how much do you do? Because this is so insightful. Because at some point, he's going to show us that why early cultures may have had a lot of female deities, for instance. Because, you're digging in the earth, and so on and so forth. And, I think it's like 35% have them, and some don't, and things like that. But you find all this stuff here. But in a horticultural society, women are a big part of the economic base. But the second that you move to agrarian with a horse, women who are pregnant can't contribute. And all of a sudden, when you get to an agrarian society, you no longer have female deities show up in the historical record. And then, again, now that we're into informational age, guess what? Women can compete in the marketplace just as well, and so it provides the groundwork for feminism to emerge and things like this. And you also talk about same thing with slavery. Societies have to sort of develop before slaves can be sort of done away with. Because in these early ones here where there's all this physical labor and they were the other, you could enslave them and sort of get to it. But finally, by the time you get to an industrial age or an informational age, society sort of has to get ready in order for these ideas of, wow, slavery is wrong, to sort of emerge. And so it's this really interesting and fascinating interplay of all these, and I didn't plan to do any of that, but I don't even know how to talk about them interestingly without it.
I think one of the difficulties with any complex model, this is kind of a superstructure model, is that there is so much to learn, and you learn it by picking up the little pieces of what you know and how you tend to think. So you think sociologically, or you think culturally, or you think scientifically, and you can learn the mega model, and then you plug in what you know, and gradually the all of it starts to come to peace. It's much like learning a language. Where do you start? Well, you start with how are you, what do you know, and then you move, and yet still you know there's this big grammar in this world of knowledge.
One thing I might mention is, for instance, the way Dan was describing it, that lower right quadrant, how social systems are determinant or determine how the other quadrants manifest. And so that's sort of a Marxian approach is that lower right quadrant. His point is they're all co-determining. You can, in the upper left-hand quadrant, have an incredible genius who helps transform all the other quadrants. They're co-interacting and co-determining. All the quadrants play a role in moving towards higher and higher integration and depth.
Let me just throw that up for just a second. I just threw up here just to kind of get you a feel, because you mentioned economic systems and stuff like this might be a way of sort of approaching these things too. When you think of, like, for instance, somebody loves B.F. Skinner, which is the idea that we have conditioned behavior. You know, this is rats in a maze, and that's basically it. Well, what is he doing? He's basically trying to explain individual external behavior. And so, in other words, Skinner and his flashlight of knowledge, you know, is correct. In the upper right-hand thing, there's clearly behavioral elements that are sort of conditioned. You know, this is, again, the realm of physics, biology, neurology. Down here, what John was sort of hinting at, that any sort of system theory that's going along here, like Marxism and stuff like that, that is trying to describe socio-economic bases. It's trying to talk about the way, you know, tribes are, you know, this is where the agricultural foraging, all that kind of stuff does. Over here, you have, this is basically the realm of anthropology, the realm of sociology, which is trying to explain the interiors, where values and truths come from, and why we agree that this is good and that is bad. So this is the field there. And then up here, if you're just developing in that upper level, you're basically looking at the interior of individuals. And so that's where Freud and Jung concentrated, Buddha, things like that. So it's, again, what he was saying about the different fields of study kind of each have their specialty here. And the danger that Ken is, really, this is the beauty of this is he reminds us that you have to, for an integrated view of anything, you have to have all four.
What is your second overhead from? Which of his books?
Both from Brief History.
Oh, they're both from Brief History.
Yeah, so, okay. But no, I'm almost positive I got them both from Brief History of Everything. All right, I'm going to really turn it over to these guys who obviously are more articulate on all this, but let me at least tell you that, okay, quadrants, do you have a sense of it? Individual and collective. Levels. Or lines, that there's these different kinds of intelligences, there's different things that we're all doing at. And at any of those lines, as well as within the quadrants, there are different levels and stages of development. And that any truth in the world is to be honored because each succeeding thing is built upon the previous one. And that if somebody is going to dedicate their life to the upper right thing, we should honor the truth that they can have. But we can't make us feel like they've got the whole thing. So that's what he's trying to do. States and types. States are, he has basically three main ones that he says are also important to consider whenever you're mapping anything. That's the waking state, the dreaming state, and the deep sleep or the dreamless sleep state. And then he kind of will often sometimes add non-dual state as sort of a fourth one. And in other words, when you're in a, that there's different sort of truths that emerge and it's different kinds of experiences you have in a waking state, a dreaming state, and a deep sleep state. So that's something to always consider as you're trying to get a multidimensional view of everything. And then when he talks about types, it's very important to also consider that there are different types of things. And so a lot of us are familiar with this stuff. This is like the Myers-Briggs four kinds of people, or the Enneagram people. You have different temperaments. What is it? The guy in Salt Lake, Taylor Hartman, with his color code, that naturally react to the world this way, other people this way, temperamentally this way. And then the key one under types that Kent talks about is the difference between male and female. And so he doesn't make these hard and fast. He's very careful to say that, you know, we all share some masculine and feminine, but there are certainly one of the most fascinating parts to me of Brief History of Everything is this interplay of hormones and in males and females, that males with their testosterone raging, guess what? What's testosterone for? It's basically the drug that says I either want to kill it or mate with it. I guess mate with it is the word they use. I want to mate with it or kill it, because it's this aggressive thing, and that's raging through our bodies. And females with estrogen and oxytocin, which males have less of, these are bonding ones. These are ones that create, like during breastfeeding, oxytocin comes there. And so women are more naturally nurturing and things like that. And so as we evolve, you know, what's a highly evolved man? He supposedly has come the female direction there. And then a lot of times we now start to think of, you know, women who, you know, or achievers at least, sometimes get a little bit of praise going the other direction. But yet, he's not making anything in these hard fasts. They also talk, he talks about men tend to naturally sort of want justice. That's their highest good. Women seem to have care as sort of a baseline thing. Again, it's mixed, but that's another type that's important to sort of consider. So the whole point of this is that at some snap, if you take any particular thing in the world to fully understand it, and before you make a judgment of it, what Ken is asking, and what the model is basically suggesting, to get an integrated view of it, you need to consider it from all these different things. What's going on here? And if we're going to judge this better than that, guess what? There's probably 8 ways to also judge it as, you know, partial in comparison with that. And so an integrated view is one that takes everything, quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types into consideration. So let me quit, because I've done not a good job of explaining that, but let me at least tell you why I'm excited about it. The two thoughts out of many that I picked for this is just to let you know that as I've gotten into this, and I really understand it better than I can say it, I think, I have found that this matches my experience. Certainly the individual, you know, stuff tracks for me. But as I've read the rest, I see that he's on to something. I trust it. And what I'm excited about in that is that the stuff I've proven really gives me confidence that there's these neat things ahead, because there's plenty of higher states of development or higher waves, and there's plenty of different types of experience. And it says that I can explore other states of consciousness. And all these things that are yet ahead for me, Ken Wilber has me excited, and it helps me not want to be complacent as, you know, where I'm at. And so, again, like I say, it matches so well what I intuitively have lived and my actual experience, that I really trust that there's these neat things still out there. So that's one thought. The last one would be the most relevant for Sunstone. One of his, basically, I don't know if I should start with my New Testament analogy or not. Basically, a lot of us get impatient, I think, with statements of religious belief that are maybe not really expansive, you know, at least in our opinions, or something like that. And what Ken has done, and it's the Eastern philosophies, I'm sure, in many parts of the way, he really says that we're all equally in touch with the divine. He uses the example of waves on the ocean. If you're a small wave or if you're a big wave, guess what? You're wet. We're all equally wet. In the New Testament, I think this is called justification. In Christ, because we turn to Christ, or whatever. God accepts us as perfect exactly the way we are. No matter where we are in the world, we're perfect. But there's still sanctification. There's still that climb to become more and more godly. But the point is, we're wet. We're in touch with God. We're in touch with the divine. And for somebody to... all you can speak about your spiritual experiences, all you can talk about your God contact with, is the language that you have, the conceptual tools, the life history that you've brought to it. And what it's helped me to do is be able to have peace as I honor people where they are and not feel like there. And I'll tell you, this was what really hit me this last week. I say, if anyone can tell me that 15 years ago I wasn't having real spiritual experiences, or those were stupid spiritual experiences or uninformed spiritual experiences, that would have really ticked me off, because I was having real spiritual experiences now. If I were to have, if my realization of wetness today, or of my God contact today, it would come out in completely different languages than it used to. But it's both are real. Everything is real. And as we hear people share something that may be, okay, I remember that 15, 20 years ago, let's not forget that's perfect for them. That's where they are. That's the language that they have to explain this beautiful contact with everything else and with God. And there's a whole bunch of stuff here. There were so many things that are just exciting about Ken and what he's doing. We didn't really talk about holons, which is really at the basis of his thing, that everything is whole in and of itself, but yet it's also a part of something else. Atoms are whole, yet they become parts of molecules, which become parts of those. And there's just this beautiful thing in the way that he does hierarchy. He calls it holarchy. There's this wonderful thing called the pre-trans fallacy that helps us distinguish. And when somebody is telling you that your spiritual experience is way lower than a rational person should have, he helps explain that, yeah, there are pre-personal kinds of experiences that are lower level, but they happen to look a lot like really high advanced ones. And so you get these people who are at this rational stage, and the higher stuff are the same when they're really not. So there's this beautiful thing called the pre-trans fallacy that he really helps with that. And it's just a really neat thing. One of my favorites, and I think Sunstone, he would probably say, is a bunch of people suffering from this, but it's boomer. Has anybody heard his term boomeritis? It's this idea that many people who are of that 60s generation, we've all gotten to this place called, pluralism. You know, we value everyone. You know, we want to affirm and leave nobody out and all that stuff. But boomeritis is the disease that says, basically, you want to value everybody and you don't make any decisions. You don't make any judgments that move on. And so he says, you know, you get these 2.5-hour meetings and nothing is accomplished because you're all worried about that. And so he's got all these just fun things that I hope will become something that you'd want to explore and value. So I am embarrassed, but I'm enthusiastic. And this is cool stuff, and these two who work with it far more professionally, let me turn the time over to them. So.
Pass goes on the next slide.
So do you want to use this or...
In the old tradition of 2.5-minute talks, although I'll spend a little more time, the name of my talk is Why I Like Ken Wilber. We agreed to take a personal view as well as an overview or professional view. And one of the basic reasons I like Ken Wilber is because I love maps. I love maps of all sorts, topological, architectural, eschatological, developmental. And I'm going to talk about the developmental. And in order to do that, because it's so complex, I would like to give you a few tastes. These are hors d'oeuvres of his parts of his theory that I've worked with. These handouts are, for the most part, made up 4 or 5 years ago, previous to my writing the article that was in the Sunstone magazine. It's November of, how long ago was that? November of 2001. And it uses a lot of Ken Wilber's integrative ideas about individual stages of development and developmental processes or theory about how we develop. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time with that. But how I found Ken Wilber was really an outgrowth of this map loving. I remember loving maps as a kid, and I pored over them, and I dreamed of them at night, flying over hills and valleys. And as a college student, I learned developmental psychology and then became interested in marriage and family therapy theory, and that had developmental maps for families and relationships. And I was always interested about internal, mystical, spiritual experience, and knew there were maps all over the place. And so I went, when I went into my period of faithful doubting or doubting the faithful, I was interested in the mystical experiences of all religions. And then I found Ken Wilber on a psychology journal when I was on the way to something else. And it turns out he loves maps also. And as Dan alluded to, he has tried to make a map of everything. And luckily, that corresponds in some ways with a dream I had as an adult. I'd gone to the optician and had put on, got a new pair of glasses, and when I went outside, I was someplace in Salt Lake City where I could see over the valley, but the lenses were not regular lenses. The lenses were much like Buckminster Fuller geodesic domes, where, you know, every pane integrates with the other, and that you can see something sort of different from each, you know, those little bird's eye glasses or, you know, lens you can see through. And at every different juncture, every different lens, you could see another level of something or another interpretation of something. So when I ran into Ken, it was like, oh, this is a dream fulfilled, and it was exciting and has been exciting to kind of explore each one. Let me turn to developmental maps, because that has been, for me, the most useful in terms of sorting out where I am. If I'm having a thought that is really about wanting to take a sweet, slow sort of revenge on a petty thing, I sort of know where I am a little bit. Or if I take, have a grand, expansive vision of something that includes everybody in the world, I sort of know where I am. So I passed out these handouts, and I'd like you, if you would, to turn to the first one. The first one, or should be on the top of your pile, is called Stages of Romance. This came from just the unpublished paper that I did several years ago trying to integrate not only Wilber, but another woman named Jenny Wade, who have also integrated every other major personality theorist, which are quoted along the top of this. So if you look at the left-hand column, what you will see under stage, it will go Wilber and Wade. Wilber, that's the names of his stages, except he keeps changing names of these. Showed up the Santaric stage, and he no longer calls it that. When I was reading him, he was calling it Vision Logic. I think he has two or three more inserted in now and calls it something else. Integral, is that right? Yeah. So he calls it Integral at this point. So you just have to know where you are at the moment, because he keeps evolving these things. So this is from sort of several years ago, but I still want to look at this because it gives a sense of how these unfold developmentally. And this little thing I did on stages of romance is kind of illustrative of how you can take all these individual developmental stages and you can use them on anything. You can use them on spiritual development, you can use them on sexual development, you can use them on romantic development, you can use them on a bunch of other sort of things. And so I was just playing around with this idea. The reason I've handed this out to you, and keep in mind, it's a working copy, it's a rough draft. I did not have John go over it because I'm sure there are many errors. So keep it as partial, please, and just my working mind at the time. But essentially, the reason I passed it out is that I can know where I am by knowing where the stages are. So if, for instance, I have an affirmative impulse towards some altruism that I not only gain nothing at the time, but I don't, you know, I don't regret it later despite the price paid, well, I will look and say, well, that might have been an integral experience, even though the next day I may be tired and I just want to be a little selfish, which may take me back to, given that I'm not hurting anybody else, the conventional stage because I'm still fair. Or you can, or if I get really angry and I only want what I want and I really do want a magical answer to prayer, then maybe at the moment I'm at the egocentric or magic stage. So I can use this map, if you play with it enough, to watch your own play of consciousness. And one of the things that's been useful for me, not just for looking at my own kind of going up and down and in and out of stages and interior states, has been watching other people also in therapy understand that when they're talking at times, they're talking from a certain stage of understanding. And yet another contradictory voice may come in. Well, sometimes I feel this way. You know, sometimes I just really want to take revenge, but I really, really do love him. You know, and I just, at the core of it, I really love him and want it to be fair, but just these rages come in on me. I sort of have the lens now that those are two stages of interior states of consciousness that are duking it out. You know, one's really trying to open to the other one's, you know, still interested in its petty fight, or that it may need something to protect but is doing it in an egocentric way rather than in a more developed way. So it's a way to play with understanding that we are all people with a number of subselves. As a birthday card said recently, you are all the ages that you have always been or that you ever have been. So that those are always interplaying within us all of the time, and that we they're playing within other people also. And so it helps orient that, and it helps the second way. The second way I find it very useful is helping figure out a mental edge, where I can grow next, or in a therapy situation, where is a person at their developmental edge, and how they can grow next. And often when somebody's at the edge of a new stage, it looks pretty chaotic or confusing or like the old world's coming tumbling around them before something else emerges newly. And so I find it just helpful. So I'm just passing this out as sort of a taste to understand things. Let me tell you a practical way of looking at this in another way. And that is to understand when people banty words around that something else may be meant. For instance, you've probably heard people who's going, well, this person just wants to be self-actualized right now, and they're just running around taking care of their own business, and so they're just being off self-actualized. Well, actually, they may be a little egocentric at the time. But self-actualized, really explained, means that all of the basic needs that you have needed to have happen, the self-needs, such as Maslow, follow that line down on needs, have pretty much been fulfilled, or that you've had them satiated, or that you found a way to build on them in an integral way. One of his concepts is, when you transcend a stage, you integrate and include all previous stages. So that you have a working model to meet all those. You are self-actualized, and that it's actualized in your life, and you are now on the corner or the cusp of moving into transcendent stages where you develop a self beyond the self. In fact, Maslow at the end of his life went to self-transcendence as the stage beyond self-actualization. So that this also provides a hint and map on those transcendent stages of how not just you have spiritual experiences that are transcendent beyond us, but that they're actually personality growth that goes beyond that. So another of my favorite comments of his is, it takes a lot of growth and work to move from altered states into permanent traits. So when a kid has a burst of altruism, he or she can't hold it. It takes a lot of work through a lot of maturity to then have altruism become a permanent trait and a reinforcing self-need. And if you have an argument with somebody about, is there altruism real? It couldn't. We always have to take care of ourselves. It tells you the cognitive stage or state of somebody who may be at the conventional stage or the rational stage beyond that, but they haven't actually experienced maybe a truly altruistic motive that runs throughout your life, and it is entirely satisfying and delicious. So play with this. Don't, you know, take it as gospel or anything else. The second way overall that I would like to play with this, and it's on the next, how am I going to do this? Is this wrong? Is this backwards? Nope. That's right. You have a, think of this. I would have made overheads for all of these, but my Xerox machine got stuck. That you can only understand these stages of individual development. And by the way, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done about relationship development. What does it look like when two people are at the same stage and having a discussion? Or that, you know, one's kind of more at a rational place and one's at an egocentric, or one's coming from a more integral view at the moment and somebody's coming from, you know, a conventional view. And how do you have those discussions? You know, that sort of thing. But that's another sort of thing to play with in the future. You can't go through stages without the processes of development so that you can have a way that it unfolds over time, but you also need ways in which you develop. These are mostly Wilbur's concepts, but I've also been interested in a number of other personality theorists and read those. So this is an integration of maybe two or three, but mostly they are Wilbur's concepts because he integrates all of those into his model, and then you can pick up and read others, and they make more sense. Because it turns out, as you can see here on your this stages of romance, they all integrate across each other, but they call them different names. So after a while, let's say you've become very interested in Abraham Maslow, and you read him, and then you go, well, where does this fit with Wilbur? Well, that's how it fits with Wilbur. So these are just, I'm just not going to spend much time with that, other than to let you take it home and play with it, except that I would like to play with it in just one way. Let's look at the one that says that you can't skip a stage. Is number four? Well, I said less about that there, so I'll say more about it now. Which is that you cannot skip a stage. You must go through them one by one. But the speed at which you can go through stages may vary. So that, let's say you're an adult and you find out, oh my gosh, you know, I'm questioning everything in a literal, concrete way. I'm totally confused. There's no map out there. You don't know of one about what's beyond it. And it turns out you're only about halfway there. It gives you a map of not only where to get there, but how to, that you have to go through those stages. But when you have mentoring from other people, you have things to read, you have discussions and new experiences, you know that there's something coming, and you can go through it much more quickly. One of these stages much more quickly, particularly from an internal spiritual and psychological growth way, is meditation. And Wilbur is a big advocate of meditation in the sense that you have access or learn access to broader, more deeper states. But you learned, this is me now, you learn more disciplined way. Your mind learns how to converge. Your mind learns how to focus on one thing. And what seems to happen is it speeds up a natural developmental process that will unfold anyway, just like it does in the lower childhood stages. They unfold in the adult stages. It speeds it up. You develop that witnessing or the meta view of how you see yourself and see the world, so that when you look at the world on a most permanent basis, rather than saying, I see you with black hair and wonderful face and pearls, you say, I'm having a thought that I'm seeing you with black hair and wonderful face and pearls. And this is what it means to me at the moment, but you might see it differently. You develop that as a permanent witnessing state of consciousness, which, by the way, is not the ultimate state of consciousness. That's only the integral view of it, or somewhat of the rational. That's not the stages beyond it. That's just one little snippet right there. So you become interested in how do I go through these faster, and you don't try to skip them. There's another reason why I think it's important to know that you can't skip them. If you, on this developmental lines idea, really are interested in spiritual development, but you're not interested in higher states of moral reasoning, you just want for yourself to become a hermit, go into it, but you don't place yourself, within a spiritual community or community of others, even if it's not spiritually oriented, you may develop that line, but you walk into the marketplace or you walk into a social setting and you don't know the social skills of tact and grace and kindness, you immediately fall on your face and nobody believes you and you look very awkward. So he makes a point, which I'll get to in the last handout, that there's some central developmental lines that you have to keep going with in a bundle to get there. And so in terms of knowing you can't skip something, then you have to go back and do the hell of ego work, for instance, in the emotional and social lines in order to really get spiritual lines. You have to, as he said, right thinking or to do right meditation. So it develops that process so you know how that can go. So let's move quickly, given we have limited time, to the last handout, which is an integral spiritual practice. This is something that Ken explained or brought up in some detail in his book called, I think it's Eye of the Spirit. Is that correct? Yeah. And then it's also been explored by other people. I have some sources down here, George Leonard and Michael Murphy, The Life We Are Given. But the idea is that you take the core developmental lines. And in this, we're not placing musical development or we're not placing, say, maybe artistic development, unless you use that as a vehicle for one of these core developmental lines, which are right here, social, physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual, which has an acronym of SPIES. I promise you I tried to figure out any other word, but in fact, Sharon Swenson and I spent probably 3 hours on a road trip trying to work around with these words and other words to come up with something that would be easy to remember. And it has no relationship to anything, but here you go. The idea is, and it's explained in a little bit here, another taste, that you pick a practice, one or two or three practices in each area, and they can be of just your interest and liking. Or you can pick up a form, like the Mormon spiritual process or the Mormon living in a community. You can pick up a form that's already a discipline, or you can do it individually, and so on. But you pick one or two or three practices, and on some of them, you do them daily to get faster growth, right? On others, you can do two or three times a week, but you continue to do them, so you map out all of those. And what it seems to be is that then this bundle or this tree trunk or however you might call it, let's say five aspen trees in a row or something, they all sort of grow together, bad analogy, sorry, they all grow together in a way that then one isn't more truncated and one's up. In that way, you will be able to sustain, say, the transcendent states that just occur and envelop in you. You'll be able to sustain the physical, the physicality of those experiences as well as the stamina to be socially integrative. You can sustain one among the other, so they each relate. There's a little tiny example, which was like a mini trampoline and all the springs around on it. You keep all of them taut. You keep them in place. And then you actually have more capability of kind of playing around with what's coming next developmentally. And there's an important reason for this, and that is when you move into a new stage, the old stage looks confusing, or you start to reject it, or you don't want to make sense of it. The new stage is barely there. You don't know what the map of it is yet, and it's helpful if you've grown in all areas and you have some sort of mentor about it, which is sort of one of the most useful concepts I've ever had in therapy, because people will come off and look chaotic or like things are falling apart. And if I know what the next stage is coming, I can deliver some good news along with, well, your life is falling apart in some ways, or no, this is a problem and we do need to take a look at it. In other words, it gives you a progressive map, not just a regressive map, when people are in severe trouble or when you yourself are in severe trouble. Let me just finish. I think this applies to the Mormon experience in that you can take parts of Mormon thought and practice, and you can integrate them into this larger integrative view that does all quadrants, all lines, all states. Thank you very much.
We have a handout being passed out, which is really not to look at now. It's just to kind of give you a little overview glimpse of what I'm talking about so you can, you know, have something in your mind. I'm going to speak rather informally, kind of tell a story, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I won't go on too long, so we'll have a little bit of discussion time. We're running a little bit late, but Ken Wilber and the Integral Institute has formed something that is kind of Ken's dream called the Integral Spiritual Center, where he has been able to contact he would call them senior lineage holders in all the great traditions, senior people who have been proven in their tradition to hold the truth through the lens of that tradition, sort of like Father Thomas Keating and Brother Stendhal Rast, two of the great meditative geniuses of the Catholic tradition today, recognized across the world, and people from some of these other traditions. I was invited to this initial meeting of the Integral Spiritual Center just about 3 or 4 weeks ago, not because I was a Mormon, but because I had been working with this Genpo Roshi in this big mind process and had developed kind of an integral approach, a full-spectrum approach to it, which no one else seemed to be doing. And so as being involved in kind of a unique exercise, which kind of the peak of the non-dual training to help people gain clarity of that ultimate state of unity awareness, and then to bring an integral piece into it. He invited me, I suppose, plus I introduced Genpo Roshi to him, who came up with this big mind process about 6 years ago. And so it was very interesting being with these tremendously mature people in these various spiritual traditions. And on the second or third day, he thought it would be a good idea to have these senior lineage holders sit in sort of a row. There's about 10 of them that were really at the peak of their particular tradition in terms of recognition of their maturity and the office they evidence in their own tradition of their having mastered their tradition, being masters. And so he got everybody up there, and I was kind of sitting next to him, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, John, you're sort of in a tradition, I guess. Why don't you get up there too?" And in other words, referring to the fact that he knew I was a practicing Mormon and yet did these other things that didn't seem to match what he would expect someone to do who was an active Mormon. In other words, most people there would view the Mormon faith as sort of a strange, cultic, little, not very highly evolved religious tradition that was very extremely mythic. And so it was a very interesting experience for me because I thought of this experience in the moment as an opportunity to bear my testimony in language that they can understand and appreciate. And something that has become very clear to me in studying Ken's work and how he synthesized the great truths from all the traditions in kind of a developmental integrative context for human development, that's the foundation of our faith. You know, underlying our, you might call exoteric, accessible to all doctrine are sort of some metaphysical assumptions and stories that are deeper, the multiple gods and forming the earth. But underlying that is a developmental understanding of the human being. And as we talk about, if you want to understand yourself, you need to understand who God is. Well, if you want to understand who God is, you have to understand the developmental process through which God arose to become the ultimate of that tradition. And so it one thing that I had noticed and had gained increasing confidence in is that in that deepest level of assumptions that are implicit in every perspective of the Mormon tradition of sort of a developmental, integrative approach, pre this life, and post this life, there's a richness there that's really incredible. If you look at all the other traditions, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, our tradition really covers all that territory extremely well, incredibly well. And maybe it doesn't cover all of the pieces, but it has this framework that is so close to Ken Wilber's deepest theoretical framing that to me it's kind of astounding. And so I just kind of prayed for the inspiration to be able to speak from that level of our faith in the kind of language they could understand. And I did that, and I kind of watched eyes start to open and widen as I went through this, with people wondering if I was just sort of reciting back Ken's theories rather than saying, you know, what, and I call it the esoteric Mormon tradition. I said, you know, forget what you know about it. I'm going to tell you about the esoteric tradition. Well, I don't know that we have an esoteric tradition, but we have an esoteric understanding, in other words, that's not known by the people on the outside and so implicit in our understanding that we don't explicitly explore it that fully or that well. And at the end of this session, I had people coming up to me and saying, "You're kidding. Is that really what the Mormon Church is all about?" I had this Rabbi Mark Gaffney, who is the leading Jewish scholar, has a center overlooking the Sea of Galilee, who's recreating the rebirth of Jewish mysticism in the Kabbalistic tradition. He came running over and said, "Here's my email address. We've got to start talking." So it was an exciting thing for me, and I think an opportunity that I had to share something that kind of flowed through my study of Ken, but also I think there was some inspiration there that helped guide me a little bit. And just, should I take 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
We have 20 minutes left in the session.
Well, I'll try to take no more than 10 minutes just to give you a sampling of some of the things that are clear to me. And the point is the richness is there, the integral richness is there, that helps give some content to Ken's theory, but Ken's theory creates a reflective awareness of that richness to help understand our own insights better and to be more reflective about them, to create practices and awarenesses to help us move in that path towards divinity, or however you understand that. And so, for instance, an example would be the nap. Well, we're not born evil. We're not don't have responsibility for Adam's transgressions or Eve's transgressions, as they call it. And yet they say the natural man is an enemy to God. You know, how does that work? You know, most of the Christian traditions say the corporal, physical, carnal aspects are evil, and you leave those behind. You know, the Catholic tradition would say, you know, if you're so weak you have to get married, then go ahead and do it, and you can create a sacrament of that. But it's better to have this meditative state, because all of that is evil. Well, I mean, how we understand it is that when you are little and your center of gravity is very physical and driven by your physical desires, that's who you are, because that's all the further developed you are. But as you grow out of that and gain control and perspective and integration of those physical aspects, you transcend and include. You fully include all of those physical dimensions, your sexuality, your desire, your physical body. You know, we're a very earthy, passionate people as Mormons, because we integrate that piece. And what is that? That's transcending and including. Instead of that level and those desires being who you are, you grow out of that, so they become part of you. They become, rather than I, they become me. Rather than the lens through which I function, they become part of me, which I have control, and which is a very rich and spiritual part of myself with the proper perspective. When we're about 8 years old, the developmental psychologist, you know, Wilbur discusses this, you begin to have a capacity to be socialized, and to have sort of what they call a conventional awareness, to integrate the values that you have. And as young people, we're taught lessons and simple rules and simple stories, very appropriate way to get a developmental understanding at that level of your faith tradition. But all the developmental psychologists will say, well, that's great as far as it goes, but it's called conventional awareness, where you can't understand or appreciate anybody outside of your own universe. Everybody who's like me and shares my values is good. Everybody outside of that circle somehow is less than me, you know. And that level of awareness is, you know, is Nazism, it's terrorism. But it's also Mormons living in Utah not being sensitive to the people living around them, because we can't see beyond our own little community. And so, for instance, if we could developmentally be aware of this progression in our own tradition, we wouldn't have a religious divide set of conversations with several hundred people participating, and the people who think they're an issue who want to participate in these dialogues are 80 to 90% non-Mormon, because the Mormons of the community don't realize there's a problem or think it's everybody else's problem. And, you know, why I had to recruit about 10 people from my ward to start filling the ranks so there are at least some Mormons in the conversation. The point is, you get somebody like Alexander Morrison, an emeritus member of the 70, who's the executive secretary for this Alliance for Unity. He's so sensitive to this stuff. He's so concerned about it. And yet some of his peers don't get it at all. And so, again, lines of development in terms of moral awareness, and I'm going to talk mainly about cognitive and moral awareness. If we're reflective of where we are and the way we're behaving and how we show up in society, we can be more explicitly aware of those developmental steps that you can't leap over. You can't become a godlike person unless you move through these preliminary states. You know, and then Joseph Smith talked about, well, you know, what is distinctive about you Mormons? He said, well, we teach people correct principles and they govern themselves. Clearly, the context in which he did that, how he talks about the importance of defending or even dying for somebody else's right to have their own beliefs as much as we should have the obligation to defend our own beliefs for our own personal integrity, is the next level up. It breaks out of that conventional awareness. It recognizes the needs of all people everywhere to be respected for who they are, and you live by general principles. The next general level up is the integral level, and sort of the highest level before you move into the transpersonal states. And what are the characteristics of the integral level? It's seeing that there are multiple perspectives on everything. In a very preliminary way, it's sort of the postmodern point of view. In a more mature way that sees there are natural hierarchies of value and whatnot, it's this integral perspective. And so, for instance, you would never say, I'm right and you're wrong, your religion is of the devil, mine's correct, so I'm going to tell you about this. And really only recently in the last decade, maybe the last 5 years, I began noticing that President Hinckley, Elder Maxwell, not too many others, would start saying, there's real truth in every tradition. And the real question is, do we have anything incremental some additional truth that we can add, and this is how we could respect people and their traditions. Another characteristic in the moral line of the integral level of awareness is that formal operational or sort of this universal principle-based approach where you include all mankind, on the integral level, you connect deeply with all life, with the planet and all life on it. And, you know, Brigham Young was really strong on this and the importance of this. And every once in a while, one of the prophets in General Conference will talk about, don't go out and kill animals for fun. You know, that's just pathetic. And yet people hear that, but they can't respond to it because they can't process it because they're not on that level yet. Just to take maybe five more minutes or a little less. And another aspect is this partial nature of all perspectives. Truth is circumscribed in one great whole, and every truth is within its own realm. That's all integral thinking. That's all integral perspective that very few people can grasp unless they're coming out of that level of understanding. Then there are four classic developmental modalities of spiritual awareness. One is after the integral level is stabilizing, so you actually, just like you access altruism permanently, you access a kind of a psychic or physical spiritual level,
John,
of awareness.
On that stages of romance, they're listed there.
Okay.
Listed
on that handout. The functions of that level are the functions of prophecy. The next level up, which is called deity mysticism, of connecting even more deeply than the whole world and everything physical, but even connecting with deity. That's deity mysticism, and a characteristic. There are all sorts of characteristics of it. One of it is the capacity to receive revelation, some kind of real, true inspiration, divine inspiration in your life that seems to be divinely inspired. The next level up, which is this causal non-dual, we don't have as well developed as the other traditions, at least the way they talk about it. It's the level, the causal level, is the level of the witness, where you see things for what they are with no ego left. And that's classically called the witness, but we have a total correlation with that, and that's the seer, a prophet, a revelator, a seer. And then there's the non-dual level, which we don't have, which can be a nice, interesting area to develop and fine-tune consciousness, even at the height of that we don't really have much of an approach to in our tradition. Another really interesting thing about the Mormon tradition is that it's never enough to gain the heights. You always transcend, reach up, but then you reach down. That's the nature of divinity and godliness, is you're always reaching down with the wisdom and compassion that you have to help others have a capacity to similarly grow and similarly experience joy, that men might have joy. And that bodhisattvic ethic is central in Mormonism. It's just that in all the Buddhist traditions, they're very monastic. They don't have the wisdom of the family and of the community and many of the social structures which we do. Another thing is our commitment to developing body, mind, spirit, our different lines of development, balancing in a way, being agents unto ourselves, developing the capacities that we have with our own unique choice of how to make a contribution in the world. That's pure Wilbur stuff, saying this is the ideal and the best. The holonic reality that Dan talked about, where everybody is an individual, but everybody is also part of a collective. It's all of all political theories will be collective, or they'll be freedom-oriented. The Mormon tradition really understands how that manyness and oneness really work well together so much more deeply. I could go on, but, you know, there's tremendous wisdom in the restored gospel in this whole realm that Ken Wilber has developed, that he frames as post-metaphysical spirituality. So you can talk about it in developmental function and integration. And frankly, I couldn't hear one other tradition saying what their core insights were to the well-being of the individual and the essential spirituality that had this kind of breadth. So it was kind of an interesting exploration for me, but I think one reason to develop a competency in Ken Wilber is it helps us become more reflective about some of the inherent depth of our own tradition to help us live our lives more richly and get on that path to eternal progression, you might call it, in a more accelerated and competent way.